afternoon. Please be seated. The next case on the court's calendar is Richard Haberstroh versus the State of Nevada, 63466. Ms. Thomas, you ready to go?
I am.
All right.
Good morning, good afternoon, Chief Justice Hardesty, members of the court. I'm General Thomas, appearing today on behalf of the appellant Richard Haberstroh. Present with me is Michael Height from my office. I will be presenting all of the argument, and I'm hoping to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. This case presents a large number of issues. I obviously cannot focus on all of them unless the court has questions on other areas. I intend to focus on three issues that I believe to be dispositive. Those are the sufficiency of the evidence for both the under sentence of imprisonment and prior violent felony aggravators, and then the dismissal of a juror shortly before deliberations. As to the first issue concerning the under sentence of imprisonment aggravator, in this case, the state alleged that Mr. Haberstroh was on parole at the time of the offense. The state did not produce any official documents from the Federal Bureau of Prisons, the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office, certifying that he was in fact on parole on the day. The state also did not produce the testimony of his parole officer, a parole supervisor, or any other person with actual knowledge of his status. And I submit that this is the bottom. This is the least that you should expect. Much like a habitual criminal adjudication where the state is to come in with a certified judgment of conviction, here we should expect official documentation establishing that in fact Mr. Haberstroh is of this status. And that without such documentation, I submit there's insufficient evidence the aggravator is invalid and it must be stricken. Unless you have questions regarding that, I'll move on to the prior violent felony aggravator. In this case, Mr. Haberstroh was convicted in federal court of escape under 18 U.S.C. 751 subsection A. Looking at the elements of that offense, there is no mention of violence or threat of violence to that offense. Following this court's recent opinion in Medicare, the next option for determining if a prior offense is violent is to look at the official documents of the case, that being the charging document, guilty plea agreement, the canvas before the district court, and the judgment of conviction. When that is done in this case, there is no mention of violence in any manner. And the state conceded such during closing argument. Instead, the state relied exclusively upon the testimony, the prior testimony, not testimony at this proceeding, but a prior proceeding, in which Mr. Weber testified that Mr. Haberstroh had fashioned a shank from a broom, held that against him, forced him into a cell, and then took his car and left along with two other inmates. We might expect in such circumstances to see charges like assault with a deadly weapon or kidnapping, but that's not what happened here. The only two charges were motor vehicle theft and escape. Mr. Haberstroh pled guilty to escape, received his sentence, and that was the end of the matter. I submit that there's a fundamental disagreement between the state and Mr. Haberstroh as to this court's decision in Redeker. In Redeker, this court considered what evidence could be considered in support of a prior violent felony. At issue there was an arson charge. This court looked at three different approaches. There was the Arizona approach, which said you look only at the statutory elements. There was the Shepard approach from the U.S. Supreme Court dealing with the Armed Career Criminal Act, which said you can also look at the official documents in the case. And then there was the North Carolina approach, which was also used by Tennessee and Florida, which said you can consider testimony, you can go outside of the official documents. This court adopted the Shepard approach, which said we look at official documents. and this court has followed Whitaker in Hidalgo and in Nunnery. And so we submit here that the state was wrong in the district court when it argued that facts outside of the official record could be considered. It's wrong on appeal here when it argues that those facts can be considered. And without Mr. Weber's prior testimony, there is nothing in this record to establish that the offense of escape was a violent offense. In the answering brief, the state also takes the position that escape is always a violent offense. But when we closely look at the cases cited by the state, the Engwin and Hughes cases out of the Fifth and Sixth Circuit, you see that those cases actually support our position here. Those cases address the Armed Criminal Act and the United States Sentencing Guidelines, which are similar to our aggravator in that they define violent felony as involving the threat of violence, the use of violence, but they go one step farther and say it also applies to a serious potential of risk of violence. That element does not exist within our aggravator. So when you look at the cases cited by the state, you see that they actually say, well, certainly escape, as defined in 18 U.S.C. 751, does not include a threat of violence or the use of violence. But they go on to analyze the case under the risk. And because that's not an element under our aggravator, it doesn't apply. But certainly the findings by the federal courts that statute itself does not involve a threat or a risk of violence would be controlling.
Is it your position that Whitaker sub silentio overrules Weber?
I don't think the issue was squarely addressed in Weber, but I do think that to the extent that Weber is contrary to Whitaker, I believe Whitaker is controlling. I think Weber dances around the issue, but it doesn't squarely say this is the evidence that can be considered.
They looked at the trial record in Weber.
They did.
Not a guilty plea, but...
And to some extent, I think there's a difference, as I've been thinking about this issue a lot. In Weber, the prior violent felony at issue was part of the case. The jury that determined guilt for Mr. Weber also determined that sexual assault offense. They heard a full trial. The evidence was under cross-examination. All of the evidence was presented. There may be something of a distinction between a prior violent felony that arises from the same case and a prior violent felony that's an entirely unrelated matter. Because here, at least, the Weber jury had all of the information and facts. As opposed to this jury, that in 2013 was evaluating a case from 1978 with no testimony of live witnesses, with no ability to meaningfully investigate. And most critically, when it's part of the same case, the jury's hearing that evidence before there's a jury verdict and before there's a guilty plea. In 1978, once there's a guilty plea, there's no need for any other action on that case. And I think, this all becomes very clear in 2013, 2 months after the trial here, when the U.S. Supreme Court issued its decision in DeConf versus United States, where in Shepard it said, this is our rule because it probably avoids some constitutional issues. By 2013, in the DeConf decision, the court is clear. There are constitutional issues presented when you look outside the facts of the prior conviction. Both the Sixth Amendment and the jury trial right, but also due process, double jeopardy, and the denial of the defendant of the benefit of his bargain. So when you, certainly I think this court was right in Whitaker to adopt the Shepherd approach, but I think that approach is mandated when you look at what the Supreme Court said in DeConf. Or DeConf, there are probably other ways to say it. Any other questions regarding that? If not, I will move on to the last issue I would like to discuss, and that concerns the dismissal of Mr. Henshaw as a juror.
Before you go there,
The state makes an argument that even if one of the aggravators were to fall out for some reason, the other would survive and be sufficient to for us to affirm denial of relief for your client. Could you comment on that?
Absolutely, and I'm glad you reminded me because I just skipped over that, and that's a very important point. When you look at the universe of aggravating circumstances, this court has recognized that some are weightier than others. A torture, a mutilation, multiple prior murders, those are going to weigh more significantly with a jury. When you look at the aggravating circumstances here, I submit that they are of relatively minor weight, either of them. The status of being on parole is certainly less of a concern than the killing of a guard or another inmate while in prison, and the special security issues there. The escape here in the world of prior violent felonies is very minimal. I submit it doesn't exist at all. When you weigh that against the tremendous mitigation evidence that was admitted here, which showed an upbringing under horrible circumstances, with alcoholic parents, I believe the evidence established fetal alcohol, even though the jury did not find that. Certainly no one contests the fact that Mr. Haberstroh had a low IQ, he had deficiencies throughout his lifetime, he was basically tortured by an older sister, left hanging in a closet, had a very rough upbringing, and then also had mitigators about incredibly good conduct in prison. Over 25 years without any violent write-ups, 10 years without a single write-up at all. He can be safely housed beyond any doubt. And I think when you look at all of the mitigation, certainly it should be up to a jury to reweigh that. I think that a jury properly instructed, especially now with the new instruction on mitigation, would find that the mitigation outweighs the aggravation. I don't think the state can even come close to establishing beyond a reasonable doubt that the presence of the extra aggravator did not affect the weighing decision. And in fact,
the state argues that even if you took out the prior violent felony aggravator for the deficiencies that you articulate, that still would come into evidence on the other circumstances in the final phase of the determination.
Certainly.
And I'd like to hear from you on that.
I think it's important in analyzing prejudice that there are two distinct inquiries. There's the eligibility decision and the selection decision. And the eligibility is limited to the aggravators and the mitigating evidence. And that other evidence, Mr. Weber's testimony, may indeed come in as other matter evidence. I don't think it should. I think it's too stale. I think the circumstances are too certain to allow it. But even assuming it did, that would not be allowed to be considered in the weighing equation for eligibility.
That he would not have been held to be death eligible were the Weber piece not allowed.
Exactly.
Okay.
And as to the jury's ultimate selection decision, they could have considered that evidence assuming it was properly admitted. But when we look
at your other arguments, I realize you're not conceding that it would have been
there. Exactly. And if you look at the state's answer in brief, they deal entirely with the selection decision and don't address the very concrete and distinct issue of the eligibility decision. And I submit that you have to look at both when you're determining whether an error is prejudicial. As to Mr. Henshaw, who was dismissed shortly before deliberations, this was a juror who answered truthfully during jury selection, answered truthfully on his jury questionnaire. Over the weekend, he was contacted by a mitigation specialist about a nephew who he had no ongoing relationship with, who he had been estranged from for several decades. He was asked about a reform school that the nephew had attended, and he reported the contact to the district court. just as we would expect someone to do. The district court questioned the juror, brought him in, and he assured the court that it would not impact his verdict, that he could remain fair and impartial. Nonetheless, the district court dismissed him, and when we look at the case law, we see that there's no support for that action.
Well, let me ask you this. As far as looking at the totality of what's going on here and the discretion that the court has, it was a fact, at least the way I understood it and looked through this, that the nephew was facing a capital, the death penalty. It was a capital case. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and then you say that he didn't have any ongoing relationship with this nephew and that he was essentially estranged. Yet one of the factors that was presented was that when he was discussing this with the judge, it evoked a visible emotional reaction to where he became emotional about it and he became somewhat, his perspective on the death penalty had changed.
Your Honor, respectfully, I think his testimony was the opposite. That he said he did some soul searching, that he brought it home closer, but that ultimately it would not change his view on how he felt about the death penalty and the state seeking the death penalty in this case.
Well, and I guess what the judge was focusing on was, you know, just how the fact that his nephew was facing the death penalty affected his ability to be impartial and unbiased and fair and in this very weighty matter.
And I think that's where it's important to look at the case law from this court, the United States Supreme Court, and the Ninth Circuit. In Hall, this court faced a case in which a defendant was on trial for burglary, and one of the defendants was the victim of a burglary during trial. And this court said she could be fair, she shouldn't be disqualified.
But isn't this really a factual determination? When you look at Leonard, there's a very broad discretionary authority here.
I agree there's discretion, but there's also a constitutional right of a defendant to have his trial completed by the jury that was impaneled to sit absent extraordinary circumstances.
And why wouldn't this be considered an extraordinary circumstance?
I think when you look at the Fields case out of the Ninth Circuit, which was a murder involving a rape, and the juror's wife had been raped and they were still looking for the suspect, and they said that's not enough. When you look at the Smith case out of the U.S. Supreme Court, where a juror went and applied for a job as an investigator with the prosecutor's office during trial, and they said, that's not enough. The disqualification standard is very high, and it mirrors the cause challenges. It's not enough that, boy, I wish I would have known that information so I could have exercised my peremptory challenges differently. That's not the standard. Here, there was no misconduct. The juror affirmatively states, it's not going to change my views on anything. My answers would be the same. I submit that if we start considering emotion, bare emotion during a capital penalty phase, that we will never finish another one. People cry in death penalty trials. It happens. We've had crying judges, crying defendants, crying counsel, crying jurors. Crying alone.
But in this context, when you're discussing his nephew's fate, and the judge sitting there and evaluating the demeanor and the way the question is being answered, who is in a better position than that trial judge to make that determination? Just so I understand, when the investigator spoke to the jury, discussed nothing about the Haberstroh case.
That's correct.
Okay.
Nothing about the Haberstroh case at all.
Nothing that...
And even the investigator had said, do you understand what mitigation is? And he said, I already know. So it didn't even go that far.
What is the legal standard that, I understand that we review for abuse of discretion, but that covers the multitude of sins. What I'm trying to derive, and I don't really get it, is what legal standard should the district court judge, in your estimation, have applied to whether or not to remove this juror, notwithstanding your client's argument that this jury had been sworn and was to his liking and trial was underway. I agree with you. It's got to be something more than there are facts that came to light that would have led the other side to exercise a peremptory challenge. But what is the standard?
In Hall, this court stated, only if the juror's answers had disclosed that she was prejudiced and could not render a fair and impartial verdict would disqualification have been warranted. And I believe that is the standard.
And was that a case where we were reviewing that the district judge refused disqualification, so we were giving the deferential review? In other words, was that a tested standard?
That is the context in which that standard was announced.
Whereas in this case, the judge went the other way. The trial judge said, we're going to excuse this juror. So does that make a different standard?
I think it should be a stronger standard on our side, given the constitutional right to maintain the jury once it's selected.
So you believe Holland State?
Hall.
State
89 Nevada 366.
And that's sort of an a fortiori kind of standard that...
I believe that is the standard. Over a defendant's objection, there should have to be a strong showing that there's...
Of actual prejudice or bias?
It's structural error.
Okay.
Thank you. If I may, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Pesci?
Just while we're on this point, and I hate to throw you off, but could you address that and why you feel that Hall either applies or doesn't apply, shouldn't apply in this case?
Yes, thank you, Justice Gregory. As I heard her just now, counsel just said that the standard from Hall is prejudice and fair and impartial. So we have in this case a particular juror who brought to the attention of the court the fact that that juror had been contacted by a mitigation expert. And that he, the juror, explained that to the court, and Her Honor took that into consideration and talked with this juror outside the presence. As you pointed out, there's a lot of discretion shown to the trial judge who sees this. And Justice Perry, the actual colloquy between the two was, and this is Juror Henshaw, and I think this is the 126 Record on Appeal, pages 25089. It's quite a few volumes in this case. It's just that, you know, I think it was more like, well, now it's my family. Like, how fair would I want the people to be with my nephew? So it was just kind of, you know, how fair can I be? That's what he says. And he was not hiding anything. He brought this forward. No one, I think, on either side is trying to say that. And as you pointed out, Your Honor, and I'm so grateful this time, because the last time I was here a few weeks ago, there was an observation that I made that the court didn't make a record of. This time, the court's also made the record of it, that being the judge of the district court level. She says, quote, Henshaw did seem emotional in talking about these matters. And she went on, the court, that is, the district court judge. But it seems to me that his emotions and his connection to the nephew who is facing the death penalty and his brother and other family members that are involved in this preparation of this case will impact him. So that's the assessment of the person in the trenches, so to speak, the judge, that is. And then if you look at Leonard, because you spoke of Leonard, Justice Perry, a moment ago, it says, prevent or substantially impair the performance of his duties as a juror in accordance with the instructions and his oath. I think that would be something, Justice Pickering, you would consider if you're coming up with this formula. And that was what we saw from this juror. Again, no wrongdoing. It was the mitigation expert reaching out to this person. And so, looking at the totality of the circumstances, I think that the discretion exercised by the court was wise, number one. Number two, should be shown deference, because they're the person that's assessing that. And if I could, I love this. I finally get to say this. Death is different. Normally that's thrown against us. I get to say it here. Counsel just referred to a case in which a burglary defendant was facing burglary, and then someone on the jury had a burglary. This isn't a burglary case. This is a death penalty case. This is where we're trying to figure out whether or not the ultimate punishment should be applied. And obviously, it is important for both sides. It's not always annoying to the benefit of the defendant. The state's concerned about being able to have a fair and impartial jury make this determination. And he, Juror Henshaw, indicated or showed that he could not substantially carry that out. And the deference should be shown to Judge Kadish.
I'm having a little trouble with that assertion, because I'm looking at the colloquy between the juror and the court. It appears to me that the district court judge asked several times, does this change your ability and I'm doing now a direct quotation, does this change your ability to be able to consider the death penalty? The answer was no. Does it change your ability to assess this fairly? No. There are a couple of pages where the judge went through this rather painstakingly in this instance, and I don't see what you are now talking about, that he was somehow unable to be fair, impartial, or to consider the death penalty.
I think what I would say is, respectfully, because you weren't there, you couldn't see him visually, to be able to see the emotion on him. Looking at the record, which obviously you have, he equivocates. There's portions where he's talking about that, but then there's the portion that I just read where he says, I don't know if he can be fair. That was his answer. He says, so it was just kind of, you know, how fair can I be? So I understand the concern, but I think that sitting in that courtroom and seeing this individual, and then, in fact, the district court making the observation of the emotion that was shown by this juror. And so with that back and forth and seeing that emotion, I don't know why she would excuse this juror without assessing all of that and taking into consideration not just the answers, but the overall presentation of this individual, and taking into consideration his nephew is now facing the death penalty.
A nephew who he had no contact with for 25 years, a nephew who he thought was up on drug charges, and you're suggesting that, and I'm not trying to be persnickety, but perhaps I am, in response to what I believe are the pertinent questions here, he answers, and you're correct, we don't see any emotion, he answers, yes, yes, no, and I can. Meaning, can you still consider all the evidence presented by both sides? Yes. Okay. Can you still consider all three possible forms of punishment? Yes. In other words, the fact that you know that the nephew is now, you know that the state of Maryland is seeking death penalty, does that take death penalty off the table for you? No. You could still consider the possible sentence along with other possible sentences that are available in this case. I can. I'm having trouble with, even through tears, finding that that is equivocal in any way.
Well, when he says that it's now his family, that's a different story, where before he was giving those answers in the questionnaire, before this colloquy, in the questionnaire during jury selection, he said he could do all those things. And then they have what you just indicated, but it's also up against the backdrop of the fact that he's admitted this is his nephew. Whether he had a lot of contact or not, he's now said, now it's my family. Now it changes how he can assess this and whether he can be fair. And I agree with you. I cannot argue with Justice Ada, and I'm not thinking that you're persnickety. I cannot argue with those portions of the record. It's when you look at the totality, when you assess all of it, that I think that it's not appropriate for this individual to remain on this jury, because now someone like me, somewhere across the country, is coming to get the death penalty from his nephew. I think his ability to be able to be fair and impartial to both sides, be able to consider all four of those, is called into doubt and called into question. I think his emotion evidenced that beyond what was the evidence in the actual colloquy. And I don't know if that answers it, but that's the response that I have.
More than fair. Yes, thank you.
And do you agree or concede that if we did find error in that regard, it's structural?
Oh, I don't like to concede anything here, Justice. It would be problematic, that's for sure. It would be problematic. If I could, changing subjects just a moment, going through what you spoke of a moment ago about Weber and whether Weber has been overturned. Unequivocally, no. Post-Hardiker, this court, in Nunnery, I think it's referred to as Nunnery 1, this court analyzed its decision in Weber. Weber was decided pre-Rediker. And this court made the following determination. This is in Nunnery 124, Nevada 477. In Weber, we upheld two prior violent felony aggravators based on sexual assault, crimes that this court noted did not require proof of the use or threat of violence. I must say, on its face, that seems counterintuitive. I'm not trying to take issue. I'm just saying the sexual assault did not be violent. But although there was, quote, no evidence of overt violence or overt threats of violence by Weber, quote, against the underage female victim during the two assaults, this court reasoned that the totality of the evidence showed that the assaults included at least implicit threats of violence, allowing their use as valid aggravators. This court looked at the totality of circumstances post-Rediker to a pre-Rediker decision where the elements of the charge do not include violence. The court went on to say, the salient facts we considered in reaching this conclusion concern the victim herself. The The implicit threats were directed at the victim and her family. However, the critical distinction between this case and Weber is that the state does not allege, when you say this, it's not me at this point, the state does not allege in the context of committing the conspiracy offense, i.e. the making of the unlawful agreement to rob, that Nunnery made any implicit or explicit threats of violence that were perceived by any of his intended victims. So we have the threat, and then it's perceived. If you look at the totality of the circumstances in our case, Weber, please don't confuse this with the decision in Weber, Michael Weber, the corrections officer who had the shank put to his stomach by appellant, clearly was threatened and perceived that threat. When you look at the totality of the circumstances, it's not even implicit, it was direct. Then you went on to say, similarly, in Hidalgo, we stated that the threat provision of NRS 200.033 subsection 2B was meant to apply in cases like Weber. And observed that the state did not allege that Hidalgo made an implicit or explicit threats of violence that were perceived. Having tried Hidalgo, I understand what we were hit with, which was in our notice, we didn't have the specific facts. And I'd like to remind you, Redeker is the same situation. It was notice. It was a pretrial writ that your honors took up. So it was a question of what's on the pleadings. Is it sufficient? And you analyzed it and said it was not sufficient. This is not that situation. This, Haberstro, is like it was in Weber. You can look at the totality of the circumstances. When you look at that, you see there's direct evidence at the victim that he perceived, that he testified. That's the testimony that we introduced. That was testimony that was cross-examined. Just to kind of put this in context really fast, a little digression. First trial, defendant goes to trial representing himself. In penalty, he asks his standby counsel to come in. They do. They cross-examine that witness. He was cross-examined. And that evidence was utilized later on. But if you're somewhat concerned with that, you can even find more reasons to find this is a crime of violence. Specifically, look at the judgment of conviction that was introduced in this case. You heard about there were no documents. There was a judgment of conviction that was introduced by Haberstro during the trial. And that judgment of conviction was for a violation of 18 U.S.C. section 751A, escape. So you have to say, does escape on its face have violence? And you heard that we conceded that. What we concede, and I'm doing it here, what we concede is that the pleadings themselves don't say a knife, a weapon, a shank. We concede that. But the actual charging document that is analyzed by courts has been deemed to be a crime of violence. Even if you don't want to do your Weber analysis, which clearly you can, should, and would uphold this. In U.S. v., and I'm going to butcher this pronunciation, I'm going to say COFOS, K-O-U-F-O-S, 666 Fed 3rd, 1243. It's the 10th Circuit in 2011. The court analyzed, and this is distinguished from the two cases you just heard from appellant a moment ago, this court analyzed the very same statute that Haberstro was convicted of and was introduced, that same section. And that court applied the modified categorical approach. And that approach was taken from Shepard, which this court pointed to in Redeker. So even following Redeker, you can get to this very analysis. And in that case, in Profus case, they apply this modified categorical approach because on its face, the elements of that charge can or cannot be violent. The courts have analyzed it and say it's, I think the term that they use is a divisive charge, meaning there are escapes that are simply walkways, there are escapes where they don't return, and then there are escapes that are affirmative acts done by the individual. And then the federal courts reviewing it, utilizing the Shepard methodology that you said we should use in Redeker, analyzed that, and they have to look beyond the four quarters because they have to determine what are the three potential types of charges that this statute covers.
Well, in other cases, that could be beneficial to a defendant, too.
It could, yes, it could, because two of those could not apply. And, in fact, I'd say in Mr. Haberstro's case, it did apply. Because I'm just spellbound by the concept of presenting to this jury and this court that he was great while he was in custody. This man escaped, not once, but twice. This man worked with a co-conspirator while he was in federal custody and got the co-conspirator out, and then he went and told on himself. This is an individual who walked away, just like you said, walked away. Sometimes he was given a furlough and he didn't come back. Those would apply. That would not be a crime of violence. We didn't seek that as a crime of violence. This is different. This is an individual who fashioned a shank out of a mop. The witness testified it was 10 to 11 inches long. That he pushed the jailer up against the wall and then put that shank to his stomach. He did not actually penetrate. We concede that. That, by the way, also Tom Lee, in 1987, put in his notice. Those facts. So we didn't have a Redeker problem as far as notice because there was enough specificity. The defense didn't have to divine where to go to prepare. He said, Tom Lee is in the pleadings, that the jailer was pushed and then that shank was put to his stomach. So you have sufficient notice to get past Redeker. You have an ability to look at the totality of the circumstances from Weber. And then you have the actual analysis from the federal courts that are utilizing the very method that you said in Redeker should be used. And that method makes it such, when you look at the facts of this case, that it qualifies. It qualifies as a crime of violence. And the fact that we use that testimony does not fly in the face of the decisions of this very court. Because that's what you had to do in Weber. You had to look at the totality of the circumstances. And when you do that, let's just say for the sake of argument, and Justice Pickering, I think you brought this up. Let's just say for the sake of argument, we're not conceding this, that you were to knock out or to strike this aggravator. The state stands by its position that you can be sure beyond a reasonable doubt that this jury would have still returned a verdict of death. And here's why. Because in the first case, the first trial, and it's important to look at this background to understand and put it in the context. In the first trial, the state of Nevada presented five aggravators. The defendant refused to let his attorneys present mitigation. Remember, they came in, they were standby, but they came in the penalty phase. He refused to allow that. So there were five aggravators, there was zero mitigation. Zero. Then, the United States Supreme Court said depravity of mind was too vague. In post-conviction work, at this point, the federal public defenders had developed all kinds of mitigation. All kinds that was not presented the first time. And the district court judge, looking at it, said, well, we can't be sure that they would have given death, even with a 5-0. So it was reversed in the penalty phase, and so we come back. And in that decision, Your Honor's decision in 2003, that's when this case was reversed, 2003, you articulated all the things that the Federal Public Defender's Office had developed, all the mitigation that should come forward. And what is amazing is when we went to trial, they presented all of it. In the face of no longer five aggravators, no longer four, no longer three. See, because the benefit of a decade of delay for this particular defendant was that McConnell came out and we lost three more aggravators. The benefit of this defendant is a decade of delay was that Redeker came out. And now I have to squirm over this potentially one aggravator. So he's gotten all those benefits. We're down to two. Two aggravators against all that mitigation. It was all presented. So you can say to yourself, if you strike one, we can be sure beyond a reasonable doubt because the very mitigation that they were told to present, they presented and more. And speaking to mitigation, if I could.
But before you go there, they also make an argument in their reply on a case called Satizan that you all didn't get a chance to really comment on. You made the argument that the Poland case meant that the fact that the one aggravator didn't end up going to the jury in the first go-around didn't mean that it was off the table and couldn't be used later. And you went through the federal cases on that. They come back with a case called Satizan. Do you want to comment on that, or are you familiar with that case?
Offhand right now, I can't remember. Is that the one from Arizona, Your Honor?
Is it what?
Is it from Arizona?
It's a U.S. Supreme Court case arising, it's a Pennsylvania case.
Pennsylvania case.
On Apprendi and Ring and the issue of whether or not there's a double jeopardy issue when the defendant, when one of the aggravators is.
I don't recall it offhand, but I think if it's the double jeopardy in the context of striking an aggravator, that was, okay. So in this particular case, unlike I believe that case went to jury. I believe that did. In our case, even if it didn't, in our case, Your Honor, this particular aggravator was stricken by Judge Guy pre-trial. It was not an acquittal in the sense the judge guy says that I think he's not guilty. The judge said, this aggravator doesn't apply respectfully from our position from misapprehension of the law because he thought that it wasn't under sentence of imprisonment, and that, in fact, was incorrect. We then brought it back afterwards, fought that out tooth and nail, and then went forward. And so it's not a double jeopardy context for a judge to determine pretrial because it's not discussing the guilt or innocence. It's not as to the culpability. That's double jeopardy. This is just whether this individual who is guilty, by the way, this is just the penalty phase, if this individual has, if this particular aggravator is going to apply to him. So that's why it's different. It's distinguishing, and there's not a double jeopardy hindrance to us proceeding on this particular one because the judge misapprehended the law and he didn't find him not guilty. He just found it did not apply. I think that was going to mitigation. I can't remember.
Yeah, you were about to talk about mitigation.
I apologize. Yes. So the argument is made to you that because certain mitigators were not found, that it's due to an improper jury instruction on mitigation. Well, I would point out to you that the state showed that there were many mitigators that were found. This jury didn't come back with no mitigators. This jury came back with the mitigators that it felt were appropriate. The fact that he has been impeccable while he's been in custody was not found, and fetal alcohol was not found. There was an argument made that the state conceded that. Well, no, absolutely not. We haven't conceded that, and specifically in the context of the closing argument, defense counsel said that they could have called an expert. We don't have to call an expert to rebut or cross-examine or attack their mitigation. We didn't need an expert. We cross-examined their experts. We cross-examined them with the evidence in this case. And when they were confronted with the evidence, it was very problematic for them. So the jury's finding of no fetal alcohol is not due to an improper instruction. It's due to the fact that the jury rejected it. And you ask yourself, how is that possible? You had all of these psychiatrists, psychologists, PhDs come in and testify, and the state didn't call anyone. Well, the problem was, as they said, they being their experts, that certain things had to exist in order for it to be found. One of the things that they talked about was that they have to have motor skills. They have to have strength. So the state countered that with, this victim was strangled to death brutally, and there were photographs of the ligature marks that crisscrossed her neck. That's just one. The other victim who survived says that they was also choked. So we impeached. We cross-examined their experts with the evidence in the case, which would give the basis for the jury to not find that. Plus, we're standing here debating whether or not this escape was a crime of violence. How on earth can we put forward the argument that the appellant was perfect while he was in custody? He escaped while he was in custody twice. Now, he was good for the last umpteen years when he was on death row. We do concede that. There are not those violations. But from the start of this man's life in custody going forward, there were many things that he did that would cut against that finding. So the lack of that finding has nothing to do with an improper jury instruction. If I could, there's one other note, and I apologize. But as far as under sentence of imprisonment, well, we had come in and testify. You heard about those no reports. Well, actually, there was a PSI. There was an agreement between the parties to not introduce the PSI because the PSI from the first trial said the verdict, death. So we didn't introduce that to benefit the appellant so that this jury would not know that a prior jury had come back with death. Both sides relied heavily on that PSI, the Nevada PSI, and the federal PSI. So there were records that were utilized to show this. Then we had testify an individual who actually was a U.S. Marshal, who was involved in the actual apprehension of this defendant tangentially as far as recovering some of the victim's property. He testified about his numerous years in being a U.S. Marshal and how he would work with people that are in custody and how he was on parole and that he bench warranted. We had all that. Plus, you just can't get past the fact that the defendant himself testified. Now, I think it's been said that this is not beyond a reasonable doubt. A defendant's admission can be evidence beyond reasonable doubt to any jury. This defendant, when he testified, said, quote, I was a parole violator for escape. That's the argument we're fighting over. Is that a crime of violence? He's admitting that he's on parole for it. He's the one that admitted the judgment of conviction. But wait, there's more. I came out here, meaning Nevada, and I knew I was on parole violation at the time. And then he went further. I ran because I thought it was for the parole violation. Now, that last one's in the context of when he goes back to New Jersey after he's raped Suzette Yake, after he's raped Donna Katowski, after he's robbed four different women from parking lots, and after he's also raped Georgina Lesko. After that, when he is caught, he says, I ran because I thought it was for the parole violation, not because I really am guilty for having done these things. That is sufficient evidence. That is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. This is an individual who perpetrated incredibly heinous crimes on multiple individuals in our community and others. And to argue that somehow that's not sufficient evidence, I think is just completely belied by the record. Unless there are any other questions.
Apparently not, Mr. Percy. Thank you. Ms. Thomas?
Thank you. I would like to first address the juror issue. The prosecutor argued that this is different because this is a death penalty case. Well, so is Fields from the Ninth Circuit, and so is Lopez from this court. The authority we're relying on are not just burglary cases. Those are two death penalty cases that support our standard. The state has yet to cite to a standard that would warrant disqualification based upon the statement, as Justice Sata repeated and doesn't need to be repeated again. This juror said that he could be fair. The standard is under NRS 16.050, which would require a showing for a cause dismissal of the existence of a state of the juror evincing, I hate this word, enmity against or bias to either party. There was nothing that Mr. Henshaw said that would warrant such a finding here. This is a person who did what he was supposed to do. We reported the contact. He thoughtfully analyzed the issue and said, I can still be fair. This hasn't changed my opinion. And he should have remained on this jury. I'd next like to address the whole Weber-Nunnery issue and Redeker. In Redeker, this court went through a very thorough analysis of saying, look, there are three approaches to this issue. We can just look at the elements. We can look at the elements plus the official documents, the Shepherd approach, or we can allow in testimony and reports and everything else. This court selected a standard. It selected the Shepherd standard, which said we're just going to look at the elements of the offense and the official documents. If this court meant what the state is arguing here, that we're just going to throw it open to all factual allegations, then why would this court have adopted the Shepherd standard? It would have said we're going to go with North Carolina and Tennessee and Florida. Tennessee has now changed and is following the Redeker, or the Shepherd standard, the Redeker standard. But there would have been no reason for this court to go through that analysis and to say we're going to follow Shepherd if you really meant we're not going to follow Shepherd. And to the extent that Nunnery goes on to talk about some facts of the case, I submit that was not at all essential to the court's holding. This court looked at the conspiracy offense and said it doesn't involve violence. There's nothing. It's complete upon the agreement. And the discussion after is just a discussion after. It's not important to the court's holding. But even if somehow the state were correct, and that without any discussion in memory, this court overruled Redeker and said, without ever stating so explicitly, we're going to follow North Carolina, you would still have to now, after DeConk, go back and say, we've got to follow Shepherd, or else we've got this huge host of constitutional issues that would be presented. And it's exactly what the prosecutor was just talking about, where he wants to go into everything Mr. Weber claimed. From 1978, how are we possibly supposed to say, first, they didn't even bother to bring in Mr. Weber, and the cross-examination of Mr. Weber at that first trial was horrible. And that's an issue that will be addressed in post-conviction, and I'm not going to repeat it here because it really doesn't matter. What matters are the official documents.
The allegations in the complaint were what with regard to that particular point?
That he escaped.
That was it?
That's it. No mention of a shank, no mention of locking a jailer inside a cell with other inmates, no charge of assault with a deadly weapon, no charge of kidnapping. There has never been a conviction for any of those allegations. There was a conviction for escape from a jail. This isn't Leavenworth Prison. It's a, you know, it reminds me of some 1960s bad TV show where the jailer's getting locked in and the inmates are lighting a broom on fire to alert people and he's running away in the 1974 Gremlin. Whatever that is, it's not a basis for holding Mr. Haberstroh to the death penalty, especially when you invoke the rule of lenity and the narrow rule requirements that aggravators are subjected to. When you add all that together, there is no basis to say that Mr. Weber's testimony or any other factual allegations outside of the conviction could be considered. The state cites to the Kufus, K-O-U-F-U-S decision. I urge the court to read that decision, especially at pages 1248 and 1251, where the court says his prior escape conviction does not have as an element the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against the person of another under United States Sentencing Guidelines 4B1.2A1. And then they go on to consider the issue under the serious risk of potential, I can't read my writing, injury. We don't have a serious risk prong to our aggravator. The Federal Circuit Court that they're relying on just told you there's no threat and there's no actual violence element to that offense. Everything they analyze is under the risk potential, which doesn't apply to us. And so that case absolutely is in our favor here. Under the sentence of imprisonment, the state wants to rely on the pre-sentence investigation report. They did not bring in the person who prepared the PSI. It is complete hearsay. It's not the problem that the PSI was not admitted and that there was just testimony about the PSI. The PSI, had it been admitted, would also not be sufficient. And this court knows from the Stockmeyer case and years of experience that PSIs have issues, that there are problems. We don't know where the information comes from. It's not always reliable. What we know here is that it shouldn't be difficult for the state to get the right documents. Someone at the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Bureau of Prisons, the Department of Justice has an official record regarding Mr. Haberstroh's federal sentence. They didn't bring that information in. They also didn't bring in his parole officer, someone with direct personal knowledge who could testify from facts. Instead, now they want to rely on Mr. Haberstroh's statements. Mr. Pesci states, well, certainly a defendant's word is enough to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, not in Nevada, it's not. We have a corpus delicti rule that says the state doesn't establish guilt based upon a defendant's testimony alone, that it has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt without reference to the defendant's statements that a person is guilty. Mr. Haberstroh could be wrong about whether he's still on parole. If he's not checking in with his parole officer, there's no mechanism that the federal government can reach out to him no matter where he is and say, okay, you're done. It's not a historic fact. Like, certainly he knows if he was convicted of something. But when his parole ended is a fact that is ascertainable. It is not asking too much for the state to obtain this most basic information. Not when we're looking at the death penalty, not when we're looking at one of two factors that makes him eligible for the death penalty, and certainly not under the rule of lenity in which statutes should be read in the favor of the defendant. I submit that under the totality of all of these circumstances here, the death sentence should be vacated. This court should find that neither aggravator was proven. You can impose a sentence of life without or order the district court to. There doesn't need to be another sentencing hearing here. He's already got four life without sentences. A fifth one is not going to make any difference. It's time for this case to be over. In the alternative, the dismissal of Mr. Henshaw is structural error, and the case should be remanded. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Thomas. Thank you for your advocacy, counsel. The case will stand submitted.